questions right to the point of that last point on cooperation and putting two together. Isn't the notion that you seem to have embraced that unions should forge cooperative arrangements with employers, isn't that still a minority view within the labor movement? How widespread is this type of thinking among union leaders, and at what point does that kind of cooperation blur the lines between unions and management, and unions get co-opted by management?
First of all, I would have to say that it currently probably is a growing minority of philosophy among trade unions. More and more unions are embracing the cooperative type efforts. You see it with the clothing and textile workers at Xerox. You see it with CWA. You see it with the steel workers. You see it with AFSCME. So the auto workers at Saturn and other places. You see it with a number of different groups. That is, in fact, a minority view, but I have to say it's the growing minority view, and I would estimate that in the very near future that will be the majority view. But again, once again, it does take two to tango. No matter how willing a union is to embrace that type of efforts, it's all for naught if they don't have an employer who is equally willing to embrace and to apply the resources necessary to make it succeed and get the benefits that's possible of getting. The other part of the question was, at what point do we get co-opted and does the line get blurred? Well, I want to say this. Probably in some instances, the line should be blurred. There have been some lines drawn that probably should not have been drawn. But I'll take my chances with UMWA members that if you give them the facts, if you give them the opportunity to play with on an equal field, I'm not the least bit worried about a UMWA member coming back someday saying that they're a member of management. And I think even if the worst case scenario were to come to be, I think we're probably a number of years away from anything like that happening. Could it happen? It could, but if the programs are set up properly and you're dealing with a strong union with equal footing with an employer, I think that it prevents that from happening.
Do you see any specific signs of Bill Clinton's posture on organized labor? He appears to have been very silent so far, lumping labor into middle-class family issues.
Tough question to answer because it's so vague. The answer is, of course I do. I think Bill Clinton understands issues facing working people better than probably any of his predecessors back to perhaps John F. Kennedy. I would go back perhaps that far, maybe Lyndon B. Johnson. I think Bill Clinton understands a couple of things. One, he understands that for the workplace of the future to come about, he's going to have to meld the labor-management relationship together. And in order to do that, the necessary ingredient is job security for the workers. I think he's committed to that. That's why he supports the Cesar Chavez Workplace Fairness Act. That's why I think he's put together a panel on labor law reform. I think he's a cautious person who wants to know all the facts before he makes a decision. And when you're dealing with the lives of millions of people, I think it's probably an excellent choice is to garner the facts and try to make a reasoned decision.
Well, I think you'll come to a test of Mr. Clinton's spirit as you go along. And the question here, or several questions, deal with the Cesar Chavez striker replacement bill, since you are one of the leaders to try to get that through Congress. One question asks whether you expect the Senate to approve the bill this year, since the House has already done so. And how would that bill affect the miner strike right now, or any other strikes, similar strikes?
Okay. First place, let's talk about what the Cesar Chavez Workplace Fairness Act actually does. What it does is prevent workers who go on strike from being permanently replaced. It does not say that during the strike workers can't be hired temporarily to come in and operate a employer's facilities. That debate on whether their strikers should be fired or not fired has been had decades ago in most of the industrialized world. All of Europe has said, workers should not be fired if they go on strike. So our competitors, our friends from Australia, our friends from Germany, from Great Britain, have all had that debate, and their countries have said workers should not be fired when they go on strike. The second part, I think, is to look at precisely where the bill is. Right now you have the House has passed it by a majority, a veto-proof majority. The Senate has a minimum of 57 senators who agree with that. Now, most people think that majority rules. Well, in the Senate, they have some nice little rules that allow the minority to block any legislation. And you have a minority right now of 39, 40, 41 senators who are attempting to block that legislation, even though a majority of the senators want it, even though a majority of the House has passed it, even though every other industrialized country in the world has passed it. I think ultimately it will get passed. As to the effect it'll have on us, it probably won't have any effect on us because our strike, we believe, is an unfair labor practice strike, so it won't have any effect on us in the coal industry. I don't know that it would be applied retroactively when passed. It may have some effect on future strikes. I think it's part of an overall evaluation that you have to look at. The opponents of that bill, well, let's take the person I quoted earlier, believe that if American workers are allowed to strike without being fired, somehow they're going to destroy all of their employers. Now let's dissect that for just a second, if you will. One, without an employer, we don't have any jobs. There's no place for us to work. Second of all, no worker goes on strike lightly. It's a tremendous cost you pay when you go on strike. You sacrifice your wages, you sacrifice your well-being, and let me tell you what some strikers feel because I get to talk to them on a daily basis. I sat around a kitchen table with strikers and listened to a mother worry about not being able to buy school clothes for her child when the fall comes. I saw a father near tears in his eyes because he wasn't going to be able to take the kids on a vacation this year. So never assume that workers take striking lightly because they don't. It's a tremendous burden on them, and they pay a tremendous price, even if, quote, strikes are successful. Now, they assume that in this country, if we're given the same right, that every other employees and all the other industrialized nations have, somehow that American workers are less responsible and that we're so irresponsible, if we're given a right that everybody else in the world has, somehow we'll abuse it and we'll destroy our employers. That's the most foolish argument I've ever heard. American workers are every bit as responsible as their counterparts around the world. They take every much bit as pride in the job that they do. And they want just as much as any worker around the world for their employer to be successful. But they also want to be treated with respect. They also want to be treated with dignity. And all of these programs, all the labor management cooperative programs, are built on trust and respect. And let me ask you a question. If after working for a company for 25 or 30 years, loyal, faithful service, you go on strike, and the first thing that your employer does is hire somebody and fire you in the process, how do you ever establish trust again? How do you maintain a mutual respect? And all the literature has shown that whenever striking replacements are interjected into the workplace, strikes get longer, they get more acrimonious, and productivity drops off for years to come. Now, can we afford in America to have long disputes that become acrimonious and destroy productivity for the next 6 to 8 years? We think not. We think that legislation will put us a little closer to equal footing with workers around the world. It will make good faith negotiations more likely to occur. and it will cause less acrimony and less conflict as opposed to more acrimony and more conflict.
You're now involved in a strike. Do you have any advice for the auto workers who are negotiating with the big three automakers on what they might do this summer?
Well, it would be extremely presumptuous of me to offer advice to the auto workers. Owen Bieber is a very close friend of mine, and he's a very capable, able labor leader. And the auto workers have a tremendously long and proud history of being a progressive union, fighting to bring social change to the country, stuff that was good for the country, like Workplace Fairness Act and parental leave, Social Security, Medicare, all of those things. My advice to any union that's about to go on strike is prepare, give it your best shot, be prepared for the worst scenario and hope for the best, and then prepare some more.
How should the labor movement deal with the increased use of temporary workers by employers, even manufacturers? Should unions oppose the use of temps or try to organize them?
I don't think you can give a absolute pat answer on should you try to eliminate temps or should you try to organize them. Obviously, I think they should be organized because temporary workers are probably the most exploited group of people in the country, other than perhaps housewives. Who are equally exploited, in my opinion. They are generally brought to work. They don't have benefits. They're not provided with benefits. They're always threatened about not being called back the next week since they're temporary. I think the Labor Management Cooperative Relationship Program, or as we call it, Labor Management Positive Change Process, that is an ideal situation where both sides can win. The employer, if it has a legitimate need for temporary workers, can have that legitimate number of temporary workers, but at the same time, they don't become so many that they begin to cut into the permanent jobs with full-time pay and full-time benefits. So I guess I'd say the labor management positive change process offers you a mechanism to address that in a way that creates a win-win scenario.
What is the mine workers' position on NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement? Why does the labor movement feel the trade agreement is bad for the American worker? And another question, well, there's a comment. Ross Perot is among the business leaders supporting or opposing NAFTA, and are you on the same side?
Well, I don't know that this will happen very often, but Ross, if you're listening, you and I agree on this one. We are opposed to the North American Free Trade Agreement. We are opposed to it for several reasons. One, we don't think it is good for either Mexican workers or American workers. We think that there will be a loss of jobs if NAFTA is passed, and I think even the GAO, Government Accounting Office, also agrees that there will be a loss of jobs if NAFTA is passed. It affects us as well. People would say, why would the mine workers be involved in NAFTA? Coal's here in the U.S. You don't have to worry about that. Well, in fact, we do, and our members understand this. If, in fact, there's a lessening of U.S. industries, if fewer U.S. industries, less electricity generated in the country, less electricity generated in the country, less coal burned in the country, that will be transferred down to Mexico, where environmental standards are substandard, to say the least. I think that's being kind. Where labor standards are virtually non-existent, talking about workers who earn a dollar an hour or less, workers who are exploited, young people, underage, that we think is just an improper way to go. The side agreements, if negotiated, probably could make the situation better, if they are enforceable. But so far, the Mexican government has indicated a willingness to sign some side agreements, but not put a mechanism in it that would allow us to enforce the side agreements, which makes them relatively useless. An agreement that can't be enforced is essentially no agreement at all. Just ask some of our members about those violations of contracts.
This concerns...
Well, this is a typing. Somebody has a typewriter.
Right. Well, a word processor. No typewriters. It's about your organizing Ziegler Coal Holding and Shell Mining, apparently two profitable non-union mines. And the question is about, does this mean an organizing revival for the United Mine Workers, since that outcome seems to be the exception to the rule?
Well, I'm not so sure that organizing is the exception to the rule. I mean, it's difficult because in this country, when workers try to organize, the statistics show that one out of every five American worker who attempts to exercise their right to form and join a union is fired illegally. Now, ultimately, they get their job back, but it's years down the road, and not many workers are able to sacrifice their wages and livelihood in hopes that five, six, seven, in some cases 7 years down the road, they'll be reinstated to a company that wasn't there. We were successful in both of those operations. They were a non-union double breast of one of the companies that we deal with. The workers voted overwhelmingly to form a union and join the United Mine Workers because they didn't believe that the main issue of job security could be handled adequately to protect them without the benefits of a union. They believe that in order for there to be true job security, you have to have a union and a union contract. They believe if you're going to work cooperatively together, you have to have a strong voice on union side, on the worker side, so that they don't get co-opted by management, and so those programs don't become a way to validate everything that management wants to do, whether it or does or does not meet the needs of American workers. Those workers showed some tremendous courage. There isn't an organizing drive that goes on in this country today where workers aren't threatened, where the law isn't violated, and where they aren't, in many cases, fired. In some cases, whole committees are fired at the same time. We had one instance, Alan, where we organized a union. The employer sat there until the National Labor Relations Board counted the votes. We won overwhelmingly. He then stuck his hand up on the board with a notice saying that the mine is hereby closed. Those types of blatant violations of the law go relatively unabated. They drag on for years and years and years. We need something better in the country, and I think the people at Marrowbone, the workers at Marrowbone, the workers at Wolf Creek realize that, and I think you're going to see more workers saying we want, need job security, and the only way to get job security is with a union contract.
What would the merger of the two education unions, the National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers, do for the labor movement?
I think it would be a tremendous asset for the labor movement. I think those are both fine organizations, and when you put them together, you have a stronger union that's going to be able to represent teachers far more effectively. There's another group of people in the country that I think really haven't gotten their fair due. I mean, we pay people millions of dollars in this country to play sports each year, but for the people that are going to shape our children's future and the future of this country, I think we underpay them, and I think that merger would better enable the unions to represent teachers across the country and better enable a coherent educational policy to be articulated and adopted in the country, and I think we need that. And just one sidelight, I think that's one of the places where Bill Clinton, I think, will shine in his ability to, and his willingness, and his desire to strengthen the American educational system. And I think at the end of his presidency, people will look back and say that Bill Clinton did not only a good job, but an outstanding job with the American educational system.
Senator Metzenbaum of Ohio has said he will retire. He has been a friend of labor. What is happening to the remnants of the Congressional Labor Coalition? Will it rise again?
Not only will it rise again, I think it's risen again. I think we have a very good working relationship with people in Congress. I think we have a number of good working relationships with a number of senators. We disagree with some senators, those that represent big business to the total exclusion of workers and think that workers have never uttered a right and business has never uttered a wrong. We would disagree with them, obviously. I think Howard has been a staunch defender. I'm sorry, Senator Metzenbaum has been a staunch defender of workers. And I think about fairness. And one of the things I've admired most about him is, unlike a lot of people, when a position was totally unpopular, Howard Metzenbaum was willing to stand up and take the unpopular position and take the criticism and the flack for it. And in my definition of leadership, that ranks very, very high.
Mr. Trumka, we have time for one more question. But before that, I would like to present you with a certificate of appreciation.
Thank you.
And a Press Club mug.
Thank you very much. I'll wear this out. I drink a lot of coffee.
Well, that's just right for it. I'd like to say again that audio and videotapes of today's luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. All proceeds of the sale of tapes benefits the National Press Club Library. I'd also like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Sherry Burton, and Melanie Abdow-Dermott for organizing today's luncheon. The last question. The traditional image of a mine worker or mine leader, well, you don't fit that image. Please clear up the stereotype. What's the typical miner today?
Well, glad my members will probably be happy about that I'm not the stereotype. A mine worker today is average age is about 44 years old, has some college, very active in American civil affairs, very integrated into the community, probably has 7 years left in the mines that they work in and understand the need for job security. In fact, I probably am the stereotype of the American miner. I'm right on the same age group with the median miner. I come from the same background. We're generally second, third, or fourth generation miners. I'm third generation. My best friend Cecil, our vice president, is the same thing. We generally don't stray too far from our roots. We stay in coalfield communities, and we want those coalfield communities to thrive and do well. The American miner is probably understanding more and more each day about the connection that they have with the rest of the world, how the global economy affects them, and they probably know more about their companies now than they ever had in their history in the past. They're smarter, they're more skilled, they're more productive, and Alan, I'll tell you this, I'm very, very proud and honored to be able to serve as their president, because they're the best.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.